King Porter Stomp. Ferdinand Joseph Lamothe. Who's that? That's Jelly Roll Morton. He was one of the great pianists, composers, band leaders, comedian. He was born this day in 1890, and he was actually regarded as jazz's first great arranger. And Jelly Roll Blues, that he wrote in 1915, was the first published jazz composition in America. And he's just written so many things like King Porter Stomp, Black Bottom Stomp, Wolverine Blues, the great Jelly Roll Morton. And so we remember him on this day in history, born on this day in 1890, and gave us so much. We're going to talk about arts in our community, and this is probably not unique to Baltimore, but we are broadcasting from Baltimore, so we're focusing on Baltimore. The City Paper had their annual fall arts issue, and pardon me for the cough I have. I'll try not to cough too much. Kalima Young, who has been a guest on the show over the last 22 years of this program at different points, wrote a piece in the City Paper which kind of inspired this program in terms of the silos we live in and why our arts community is so separate, and can something change with that? And how does that change? Which is how she kind of closed the article. So we're joined here by Kalima Young, who's director of the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project, a project of the Office of Community Engagement at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Deanna Hagag joins us one more time. Good to have you back with us. Deanna is director of the Contemporary Museum, formerly curator in residence at the Gallery CA,
yep.
Right? In Baltimore City Arts Building. Mia Loving's back in the house. Good to have her with us.
Hello.
Community organizer, entrepreneur, mother, and wife, and artist. Good to have you in the studio. Baynard Woods joins us by phone, senior editor of the City Paper, who put this issue together. And Baynard, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, y'all. How are you?
Good. And you all can join us out there at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We're going to get to Sheila, our first caller up, in a second. But I just want to get around this roundtable here fired up, and then we will jump into our phone. So please join us at 410-319-8888. And so, Kalima, I want to just talk a bit about the piece you wrote for the City Paper and why you wrote it.
Well, I wrote it because Baynard actually contacted me, and he wanted to know if I had any perspective after having worked in building the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project over the last few years. And he wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of silos that he'd been hearing about and if I could provide some perspective based off of the work I'd been doing. And it's a conversation that often seems to happen in the work that I've been doing and trying to understand the ecology of Baltimore's art communities, who's doing work at the intersection of art and social justice, who's getting the funding, who's not getting the funding, what kind of infrastructure needs to be created so that there's equity in the art scene. So when given the opportunity, it was a chance for me to look back at my data over the last few years and really synthesize it into a piece that I was hoping would be a catalyst for further conversation.
And we want to try to push the conversation in the air here today. And Deanna, you came to Baltimore from California, right?
New York,
okay. Well, one or the other. One of those two places. And you've seen some stuff around the country. I'm just curious, just from a national perspective, how unique or not is Baltimore in its separateness when it comes to the arts world?
I actually think Baltimore is on more of the progressive end in terms of fundraising and race and the arts. And I think that Baltimore does a better job than a lot of other places in the country that I've seen. And I think you touched up on it earlier. I mean, this is not an issue that's unique to the arts, that's unique to the city. I mean, this is happening nationally, globally, in sectors all over as a result to sort of continued and ongoing segregation and institutional racism. So I actually want to have a conversation more on the merits of the city and the ways that we're advancing this conversation, because I think it's a healthier way to prolong the good work that's happening as opposed to sort of only focusing on some of the downsides to the work that's happening here.
Good. We don't have dialogue and write a brew here. This is a good thing.
Yeah.
Mia.
Answering the question.
how you see it as somebody who actually is a community-rooted artist, how you see it?
I have the opportunity of, like, going through a lot of different circles and hearing a lot of different perspectives, and it becomes very obvious very quickly that there's a lack of fairness involved in who gets what and when they get it and how they get it. And, you know, a lot of artists are frustrated. There are older artists that are frustrated because they've been leading the way and doing a lot of work and a lot of groundwork and have created a great legacy and struggle to keep their organizations open every year or struggle to eat every year, and see young artists coming straight out of college getting a building for $1 a month or getting a huge grant to, you know, paint a sidewalk that says hi or something like that. And then you have young artists who are frustrated, who aren't able to navigate any of these spaces because they've been systematically outed. And because if you hear urban or young, that automatically means violent or unorganized or all of these things. And so there are so many bubbles and sections, and most of them don't even know that there are sections of the city getting so much money, or organizations. And when I'm using the term organization loosely, I'm talking about a group of people that met somewhere and decided to create some type of collective and get some gain some type of access or money. I'm in some spaces, and I hear, you know, what she said, the great things that are happening in Baltimore are so great, and then some, like, I don't know how it's going to change. Neither of them are seeing each other or knowing what's going on in either pocket. And so, you know, I've been here to just kind of bring awareness on both sides, more or less.
And Bernard, from your side, I mean, you asked Kalima to write this piece. I'm curious, and you even your piece, I think, was also blatantly honest. It's something that the city paper also has to wrestle with a lot, which is the fact that the staff is, except for in the days when Brian Morton was there and a couple of other folks that I knew back in the 90s, is essentially a white staff.
Yeah, and it's something I've been thinking about ever since I've been at the paper, and it really came to head at the 2013 Transmodern Festival when I was writing a piece on that, and when they were setting up the Rooms Fall Apart play. And there are a lot of artists working in MAP's office over on Saratoga Street or in that building. And there was a middle-aged African-American woman and her daughter working. And they both, it was the 10th anniversary of Transmodern was what I was doing. And they both said that they had been doing art in the city for the last 10 years. And this is the first time they'd ever heard of Transmodern. And so for especially a festival that's trying to cross lines, it struck me that how tragic it was that it had taken 10 years to even start to cross over there from East Baltimore, and to start to cross over into East Baltimore to for people to be aware that people with similar-minded ideas in art to be even aware that each other existed. And the other white artists who were in there working alongside of them were laughing and like, we had no idea that you were doing this there. And so it's something that I think is that it is something structural, that it's not something people try to stay isolated. It's just the places that people go. And it's what happened with us, I think, is that the paper for a long history was seen as the white paper. And that made it become more and more the white paper. Lawrence Burney, who writes for us, says that he had no idea growing up until he started going to UB and came to the center of the city, that he had no idea that the city paper even existed. And sometimes we have a really hard time trying to get artists to be interested in talking to us at all, because to them, the city paper may not be relevant at all. And that's a sort of tough pill to swallow. And I think if we're going to survive, it's exactly what we have to do is address these problems.
So, Kalima, I want you to kind of, Kalima and Diana, and then we can go to the phones, and Sheila, 410-319-8888. So when we use this word all the time, mm-hmm. structural, that there's this structural racism that keeps things divided, that doesn't let things happen. And you wrote in your piece about the silos and how, and you had some really interesting analysis about the notion of silos, how we all live in these kind of very separate silos, right. Which we do, I think, in many ways. But what does that mean in reality? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, we always use this word, but what does it mean? Why, and what do we contemplate is happening to change that?
Right. When I talk about one of the reasons I wanted to break down this idea silos is because we keep using it as code. It's being used as sort of the shorthand code to talk about racism and the shorthand code to talk about classism and the way those things are separating people within the arts community. And I rather strip away from this conversation of silos as code. If we're going to talk about race, then let's talk about race. If we're going to talk about racism, let's talk about racism. Let's not just call it, ooh, we're siloed. But when I think about silos and the actual definition of a silo, it is about an organization that has many different departments, and these many different departments are not talking to one another. Because infrastructurally, there are not things in place to make it easier for folks to talk to one another. So some of the infrastructure issues that I've been aware of and the mapping that I've been doing involves not, and they have a racism in class laying underneath of them often, but there's an issue with communication, like putting information out there so that people will understand and see where they can receive resources. There's something related to geographic boundaries. We have a horrible transportation system that doesn't take people safely from one end of the city to the other. I don't want to go down in Fells Point as a black woman at 12 o'clock at night to go to a show. I'm not going to do it.
Why?
Because I don't necessarily feel safe in an area where there's a lot of white boys drinking and running around and acting a fool during the school year. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, like, that's why I asked why.
Right. So, like, there are actual geographic barriers. There are bridges that separate neighborhoods from seeing one another, from being able to access one part of the city to the other, and transportation issues. There's lack of communication of the resources and the funding opportunities that are out there. There aren't necessarily opportunities where people are allowed to network and learn of each other in a structured manner. And these are the ways that the silos are continuing, the silos with their racial and class undertones continue to exist.
So, Didiana, how do you see things changing? How do you see, when you talked earlier about, you see that there's another part of the story, which is positive moving ahead. Where is that?
Well, I think in order for, my concern with conversations like this is that it feels like we're having them without any context. And it feels like there's a lot of miseducation and misinformation. And we're sort of talking very vaguely about things that really need nuanced approaches to sort of consider. So for example, Mia, when you're saying, there are all these collectives and organizations with funding, I really need to know who those are, because I feel like that's another misconception, that things like an arts district has a ton of funding from the city and they're not fairly, you know, sort of distributing it to the people in need. And the difference between an arts district and the nonprofit that runs the arts district or the various organizations that exist that are trying to do this work. Another concern of mine is that there are a lot of amazing organizations in the city. The one I think of the most is the GBCA that's trying to have these conversations openly about race and silos and the various ways that we are separated. And my concern is at the end of these conversations, for me, always end up this sort of strained blame game. And that makes me nervous. So for example, Kalima, in your article, you open with the young 30-year-old white theater director who said that he had a really hard time getting a new audience in, or sort of diversifying his audience. And my concern with sort of even calling him out on that is that that was the exact safe space for him to have that conversation. And when then that person is sort of isolated and sort of used to open your article in a sense of saying, I can't believe this person didn't know about these resources, how do we advance that conversation if we keep holding people back from asking difficult questions? And when we were, I mean, my job at the Contemporary, I've been asked a million and one ridiculous things. And my first impulse is to go, how can this person not know about the work happening in Sandtown, Winchester, or, you know, alternate routes? And they don't. And to sort of open their minds and to have more honest conversations without playing this almost, it just feels like when we're not talking with context, it turns into a witch hunt, that there is somebody who is wrong and somebody who is right, as opposed to saying there's just a lot of communication breakdowns happening in the city. And I'm eager, pleased to hear your thoughts, because when I first read the article, I was so excited. And then it sat with me and it felt like, well, how does this advance the conversation as opposed to just sort of sitting there vaguely with no real address as to what's happening to sort of advance these things?
Well, that, and then we'll come over to
the yeah, sure.
That conversation, yes, it was a safe space for him to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him very directly, hey, why don't you just talk to the theater director that's there? Mm-hmm. So bringing up a conversation and noting the fact that, you know what, there seems to be a disconnect here. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that is not playing a blame game. It's noting that there is a disconnect that is there. It's not calling someone out as being somehow, oh, my God, that means that I am blaming you for some particular issue. It's saying, hey, guess what? Look at what is around you. You are sitting here in the arena player's office. Why don't you just talk to the director? And he's just like, yeah, that makes sense. That was a truthful conversation between two people talking about a racial boundary that was occurring. There was no call out that was happening in that incident. Mm-hmm. And that is what that is why I opened the story with that. It's just like, hold on. We are vaguely talking around this issue of race without actually opening our eyes and seeing where we are as a location, as people. And this was a perfect example of what I'm talking about when I talk about silos.
So
If I could add one quick thing on that, Mark, we generally don't allow unattributed sources or pseudonyms like we had in that, but it was because that these conversations happened in a way that were safe spaces and not off, right. Not on the record, that we allowed the piece to run like that so that it wasn't trying to play a blame game with a particular individual, calling an individual out. And so we felt it was really illustrative of the same kind of thing that I saw at Transmodern, or where people are right beside each other and not noting.
I know, I thought it was important not to have the name called out. And I think, but I want to come back to what just happened with Diana and Kalima. Let me first go to Mia, though. Mia, because you want to also kind of think about what just was said.
Yeah, definitely. And I would like to point to a lot of specific incidents, but I didn't get permission from, certain voices to say that. So I can only speak generally in this case. But I'd like to say one thing that I've been focusing a lot on, or one thing I realized once I started seeing this segregation occur, and I don't like to look at anything from a personal or individual level, and I even put these organizations in here. I'm not blaming any of these organizations, GBCA or whoever, because I haven't talking too closely for it. I know when I'm approached by these organizations, it's more so sign up for our list or thank you for saying what you said. It's never come to this grant meeting or be on this board or any of those things, having me or anyone that looks like me inside of the decision-making table. Sometimes, but not so often. But more so, what I've been focusing on is the city granting permits in certain places but not others, licenses in certain places and not others, based on who is approaching and what they are bringing to the table. And businesses are a huge reason or platform, either because these businesses are the spaces where this art is able to happen and grow, or it's because the business associations control a lot of areas to say, we want police in this, or we don't want this, or we do want this. I live in the Station North area. I've gone to the Charles Business Association. I haven't gone to the community association yet, and I've been to certain meetings or heard certain things for those who work in the organizations in this area, and there have been three or four people at a meeting that have said there's no way this particular business is opening up in this area, even though that business might have history or it goes along with entertainment and arts, but they fought against it. The owner of what was called Choices Gatsby's died because of the stress of having them call and call and call trying to get that place shut down, to the point he was open one day a week, renovated the place, was going to represent it, and he died before that happened. Now, those in the area, one woman who is known for being racist, she owns half of the property in Station North, is trying to buy that building. This can mean even more pushing out of young Black arts especially. And across the street from Choices is a business who is open to the older community, open to the newer community. It's a popular place. It's a successful business. He had an issue with something falling. There's money in the area to help a business if something happens like that. He got ridiculous terms based or compared to others who were wanting to renovate a space, don't have to pay the rent, all of these. These aren't like magical scenarios that I'm making up. These are very real situations that aren't just people not knowing. Is, some of it is people don't know this opportunity. Some people are trying to get these opportunities and are being systematically pushed out from it.
So maybe I want to kind of get very precise here about some questions that have come up because of what all the four of you have said. But let me go to the phone to you first at 410-319-8888. Sheila, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Hey, Mark. This is Sheila Gaskin.
I know that voice. Sheila, how are you?
I'm fine. And the thing about this is that I am the family, the middle-aged woman and her daughter. I was the one that was a part of Transmodern Room Fall,
right?
213. So how you doing? So I am privy to this. There is a big divide. It has always been, but it has not originally. It wasn't like that because I remember at a time with Joyce Scott and Kayla Wall and Center Stage and all of us used to do theater and we would have directors come from New York and we would make and create some things. But now it's gotten to the point where there's haves and have-nots, and it is obvious, and it is so rampant and so real, and I'm heartbroken because I see this. I've been a performer around this town for a long time, and it is not fair what I see, numbers or not numbers. And we cannot hide behind the fact that it's art that makes it equal. I performed recently at Tongue Tied in a theater that I will not say the name of it, but it has collective in it, and they looked at us like we were going to steal something from them. And this is last month. So it's a real reality for people of color. It is not fair, and something should be done so we can move forward. I love this town. I'm so about this town. And what's happening, it is not cute. We need to talk about it. We need to address it because we only get richer. That's how you tell how a city is, by its culture. And because it's so segregated, people are missing and things are lacking. So in closing, I wrote this little poem, but I'm not going to do the whole version, but it's called Art Part Tide.
Go ahead.
How did we get here? A call to arms. Art Part Tied. Shame on you. Shame on me. You call yourself an artist, but where are your varied hues? I don't see yellow, red, black, or brown, yet those hues are the majority in this town. Where do you live if all you see is a sea of white from sea to sea? Art Part Tied. Shame on me. Shame on you. I call myself an artist, too. I can't forget about my truth if all my hues are just like me. Blacks, purples, browns, blues, and greens, from here to way over there. No lights, no brights, no whites in sight anywhere. How could this be if I don't see that white in you is part of me? And if I don't see that light in you is in me too? Because when you teach black to hate white, don't you teach dark to hate light? Apartheid, apartheid. How did we get here? Nobody's supposed to be here. Separate but equal? According to whom? The haves, have-nots? That's how we do? They writing the checks. We do what they do. Apart. Tie a yellow ribbon round the old oak tree. Competition is steep, and everybody here, we standing in line, prepared all year. Who will win? Who deserves to be here? The work is hard, the laborers are few, the competition is over. Who won? If not me, did you? Apart, tied. Art, part, tied. Thank you.
Sheila Gaskins, come back to the studio soon. Thank you so much for calling.
Bye, they love y'all. Peace.
Thank you, Sheila. Go ahead, girl.
It's also scary for me personally when my students, former students, call in and they're middle-aged now. What does that make me?
Oh,
well, that was good. So I want to come back and wrestle with some of the stuff. We have a lot of callers calling in. Yemma, Danny, Changa have all called in. I want to get their thoughts on this. But I think that we have to kind of really wrestle with why this exists in Baltimore and what we do to really alter it and change it. And I was saying earlier that Peter Brune is one of those artists in this town who makes an effort to really change it. I think to change the nature of things, you have to make an effort to change it. Mm-hmm. You just can't sit there and expect people to come. And also, right. There's more than just people to come. There are also so many things happening in the black community artistically that are not put out there as part of our artistic scene.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to get to all that. We're going to come back. We have great guests here. Dina Hagag is with us, Mia Loving is with us, Ben Woods is with us, Kalima Young is with us, and you all at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. We are going out here to this break with Step and Razor, Peter Tosh. born on this day on the 19th of October. Oh, wait, was born on the 9th of October. We don't want to forget him since yesterday was his birthday. Stay with us. If you want to live, live, I beg you, treat me good. I'm like a walking razor. Don't you watch my size. I'm dangerous. Said I'm dangerous. I'm like a walking razor. Don't you watch my size. I'm dangerous. Dangerous. Coming back with Peter Tosh, and in the studio, Kalima Young, director of the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project, Dina Hagag, director of Contemporary Museum, Mia Loving, community organizer, entrepreneur, mother, wife, and artist, Bernard Woods, senior editor of the City Paper, and y'all at 410-319-8888. And I promise to get to the phones when I get to these people in order that they called in to get their thoughts on here. It looks like a lot of artists are calling in about this and want to wrestle with this. So the question is, I mean, part of it has to do with, all right, let me ask this question. Does part of it have to do with how the money is controlled and where it goes? Is that a piece of what is stopping the kind of growth of art and the intermingling of art across community lines?
Oh, I mean, of definitely. Course, this definitely has something to do with it. And I brought this issue to the mayor's Arts and Culture Town Hall that was just recently. And the answer that I get is what you're talking about is underground arts. And what we really focus on is mainstream. I didn't want to take up that whole space, but I wanted to go off on her because I never said who I, you know, that I'm talking about underground or mainstream or anything. Shayla Gaston just got off the line. She's a full-time artist, you know. She's if somebody gave her a $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 art residency grant, I don't think she would turn it down. I really don't. She's been doing this for so long. Her daughter is a full-time artist.
Right.
They've been doing this for so long. This is not the thing. And then again, I'm talking, you know, we said Station North can be like the for this, because historically that was a black arts area. There was a black theater there. There were black clubs there. There were this and that. Where Micah is right now on North in Maryland, that was Morgan. Zora Neale Hurston went there. You know, this is the history there, that mm-hmm. if you're walking on North Avenue, you can see on the ground sometimes Harry Belafonte, this and that. This mm-hmm. is something that's not being preserved. It's not something that's being highlighted. It's something that's forcibly being pushed out. I'm not talking about in other areas where gentrification happens, where some people are getting tax breaks and others aren't, and then they're being priced out. They're still not being priced out. They're saying, you need to leave. I need to call every day to make sure that your permits and licenses are being taken away, because I don't want you here. The police, you know, made it seem like outside of Red Emma's, that Red Emma said that people couldn't stand there. They didn't say that. The police did that, and they told people they could not be there. And the way that Baltimore is, different from like D.C. or New York or Philadelphia, you know exactly where to go and when you want to just hap upon something. Baltimore is still a very destination place until these places are fully developed or infrastructure, which means that it's very relationship-based, which is where these so-called silos kind of happen, because the people that you know are the ones that come in and know and this. That being the case, there has to be a varied approach to outreach that's not happening.
Let me go around the room here to answer this question I just posed. And Adina and Baynard and Kalima, I want to get to the phone, see how many people respond to what you're hearing. Yeah. Dina?
So I do think that absolutely how funding is achieved and where it's sort of where it's distributed is an issue and is problematic. But again, I also think there's a lot of misinformation about how these things function and how they operate. And I only say that as somebody who up until 2 years ago had no idea. And now that I run a small nonprofit and have to deal with this sort of side of the city and funders, I mean, I have so much more insight to how these things operate. Namely that, again, I want to know what we're talking about when we say there is so much money and it's not being distributed evenly. Because I want to know where that sentiment comes from, because due to where I am, I know closely where all that money comes from. And I don't agree that there's just all of this money somewhere and it's not evenly being distributed. I think all cities have master plans, and I think the master plan for this one is that there is more resources to some extent afforded to arts districts, at least in a media standpoint. But I don't know that there's necessarily huge pockets of money that are being held back from certain communities. I agree with Kalima that more so than funding, there's a geography issue, and there is a we use the internet to do damn near everything, and that becomes problematic because certain pockets of the city don't hear about a lot of the grant opportunities and the various events and what have you. And I also agree with Kalima that there are certain parts of the city you physically just can't get to if there is a workshop going on or something happening. Mm-hmm. So I think focusing on those things is more helpful than necessarily looking at the funding, because I think the arts is struggling across the board funding-wise. I just think there's not, and I mean, Kalima, you're funded to do Baltimore Art Plus Justice. I'm funded at my role at the Contemporary. It's not barely, what we want, and yes, it's not ideal, but we are, right? And we know intimately how these structures work. Mm-hmm. And you're operating out of an institution, as am I. Mm-hmm. So to some extent, examining that privilege, but also saying it's still not easy, you know?
I agree, but just quickly, I'll say it's coming from people who $1,000 seemed like a lot when you're using fish dinners to, you know, fund for your organization, mm-hmm, because you get zero. So
I think also the infrastructure, the way funding is set up, I remember, and once again, I'm going to pull from conversations I've had with people that are safe spaces, so names are not going to be thrown out there.
Please.
That's just how it works. I remember having a conversation early on with a head of a nonprofit, two heads of a non-art, after-school nonprofit organization that were arts-based. And I was talking about, so how's funding impacting you guys? How you're on the east side, you're on the west side. How is the funding situation? Do you ever want to collaborate with each other? Mm-hmm. And them actually saying, we want to collaborate with each other, but we get money from the same exact philanthropic organization, and they don't want to fund transportation because they think one, they won't fund us for transportation, and two, they think that they've funneled all their money into this particular thing, so we can't do something similar to them because the funders only want to pay for one version of this particular arts intervention. So when you have arts organizations that actually want to work with one another and they want to make the kids cross these geographic boundaries, mm-hmm, but they're getting funding from one particular source or one particular nonprofit who's like, we only have so much money, so we're going to give it to this intervention and not the other intervention, you have an infrastructure breakdown where funding comes into it. Another perfect example to me is the neighborhood transformation grants. I write about this in my piece in the city paper. This is an awesome opportunity for neighborhood residents and artists to work together to do something in their neighborhood, but they don't have the funding of an outreach team to go out there and actually engage and do community organizing in specific neighborhoods around the city to let people know that this opportunity is there and that they can build coalition.
So
that's an infrastructure funding problem.
And I want to get the phones. Bainer, I want you to jump in here. I want to get the phones and read a comment that came in from Brett Emmes just now that I think has to be read. And to say, like, neighborhood transformation, we're going to just throw this in before I go to Bainard. Like, let's say Liberty Heights. Mm-hmm. There is the Forest Park Senior Center in Liberty Heights that has artists, theater workshops, art workshops. Mm-hmm. They're not getting funded in a major way by the city to develop in a working class black neighborhood the art scene. It goes somewhere else. And I think that, and they've been around for a long time. They have jazz concerts there. They have all, it's incredible, you know, what goes on, but nobody talks about what happens, mm-hmm, in upper Liberty Heights near Gwin Oak Avenue. So that's part of the issue, I think, as well. Bainer, let me let you jump in, then I'm going to go to the phones here.
Sure. I mean, I think one thing that's important to mention is that we are having this conversation around arts. And so it's, you know, it's not that the arts are worse than the rest of the city. It's that this is a problem in some ways with the city. And so the fact that Around Arts gives us a chance to talk about how the city itself is segregated, I think is a really one of the useful purposes of art, that we're able to address it in this way. And I do think that what Mia said earlier about her remarks at the mayor's forum about underground art versus, you know, mainstream art is there is something there that some of it isn't. And I agree with Dina that there's not just money flowing, you know, really a lot of money flowing anywhere in the arts, but some of it is what gets allowed to happen as well and what gets, mm-hmm, shut down, mm-hmm, or not shut, right, down, and the way that perceptions happen. And so that when there's an underground concert at a DIY space that's primarily hip-hop artists, then you're going to have, it's going to be much more likely, like at the Broom Factory last year, to have the police come and shut that down, though they've been doing a fine job of shutting down all sorts of DIY spaces over the last year and a half. But, you know, or the other story that we wrote about in this issue about Young Moose, his video being treated as evidence, where Bosley with machine guns and his videos aren't treated as evidence, but are treated as art. And so I think there's, funding is a big issue, but I think it's also what's being allowed by the city itself and what's not being allowed. So the mayor said she wants empty lots in every neighborhood to be performance spaces. But I find it hard to see that if you see some guys, the police officers seeing guys standing, performing and say rapping on a corner in an empty lot performance space are going to let that happen in some neighborhoods where they are going to let some folk guys with a jug or something get away with doing the same thing in another neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So let me go to the phone chat. Please, callers waiting on that. We hear their thoughts. I think many of them are artists calling in. I'll read this. Renema's call to say that, let me just get this right, that no one from Red MS has ever called the police on people chilling outside, and they have almost gotten arrested confronting police from harassing people out front. And so that was a comment that was made by just someone calling in from Red MS. 410-319-8888. Yemma, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi, Yemma.
Leaders of A Beautiful Struggle have addressed just this exact issue, and I heard them address it on your show, and they did it eloquently.
Yes.
There is a major problem with funding, not just for nonprofits, for arts, at all across the city. And that's why they don't have any city funding, because they wanted to be able to work freely. And let me say this. I couldn't seem to get funding or grants. So I went to a person I knew who always seemed to get funds and grants, and we were sitting there talking. He stepped out the office for a minute, bring the phone ring. And I'm not going to name the funding agency, but they called and said, look, I have an extra $150,000 left in my budget. Do you want this? I almost fell off the chair. Never in my life did I ever think that someone got grant funding just like that. And the second thing I'll say is I applied for a grant, and I was told I didn't get the grant because I had spelled a word wrong. And you look around and you see people who have friends in the arts funding institutions, and for instance, we just had a festival, and they say, well, I have a friend who works in the office who will make sure we get funding. These things happen. Blacks are cut out, shut out, left out. We're used as resources. Mm-hmm. We're used as partners to get funding. But when the check gets cash, they dash. And I don't know what to do about it. I don't know what to do about it. Thank you.
Hey, Yemma, let me get a couple of questions that we can all kind of leap in and kind of discuss what we just heard. Danny in Waverly, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the excellent conversation. I wanted to chime in and echo some of the sentiments being voiced. I wanted to comment on my perspective as a recently transplanted artist from Chicago. Upon arriving here, I was really, really horrified at the segregation at the art events. I was attending poetry events, music events, and theater events. Chicago, ironically, traditionally, and still very segregated city. That's not the case in the arts scenes that I participated in. When I landed here and saw only white faces in event after event after event, and then turned the tables and started to attend events on the other side of town, so to speak, and I was the only white face, I thought it was extraordinarily bizarre. And then upon speaking to artists about it, among the European American artists, just kind of bafflement and apathy. Oh, really? Oh, you think that's an issue? And haven't gotten to get a read on the African American artists if that's where they feel about that. And these are primarily at DIY events. This is events I attend generally are not heavily funded, and the onus is on the artist to reach out and have some type of perspective. And I think that's their responsibility. It's our responsibility as artists to be smarter than the average apathetic American who accepts this obscene level of segregation. I found that extraordinarily disappointing. And I could go on and on, but I'll close with that.
Danny, thank you so much. And as you say, Chicago, we were talking in a staff meeting the other day about that Red Moon, which is a mostly white theater in Chicago, there's a huge explosion there over who gets funding, and mm-hmm. they got this money and other folks didn't. But I think that when you do go to Chicago, I've been there, that the scene is overall much more interracial than we have here in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Let's go to another call and come right back to our panel here. Changa, you're on the air.
Hey, family, peace, how's everyone?
Very well, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good. There's a lot of little nuggets in this conversation. I'm really enjoying listening. I had to chuckle when I heard underground art referred to basically black art being underground art, and that's funny in a 65% black city. The arrogance of how anybody could call black art underground. But aside from that, I did want to say some unpopular things about funding. There's no way to have a conversation about funding for decidedly black art, and I really don't like the term black, but that's another conversation, without having a conversation of how it ties to reparations and the whole Ta-Nehisi Coates piece. Because if this is a black thing that without funding will not flourish, and we're intentionally not funding it or defunding it or underfunding it, then that is an intentional piece. I'm a nonprofit professional, nonprofit leadership alliance, and I know for a fact, which is going into my second comment, that this the money, this mystical the money that we keep talking about, which goes to the other young lady's comment, doesn't exist. Much of this money is hard-fought money that has come from community pockets where, you know, people who know have gone to those community pockets and farmed that money and established those relationships over years. And so, yes, it's many of the so-called white people feel that this money comes from our communities. It should support things that we like and things that we feel. So I'm really encouraging the so-called black people because that, you know, we need to take our own money. There's 300 and something thousand black people, over half of them above the poverty line in the city, just in the city limits. And so there's no reason why there's not at least one organization that is taking on as its mission, as its duty, to collect some of those funds,
okay,
get in touch with the Eddie Browns and what have you, and make our art more prominent.
That's interesting. Let's jump into all this here. Who wants to go first? Kalima, why don't you just go around the room?
Mm-hmm. Oh, golly, reparations.
We can go. That'll take another 3 days.
Yeah, man, that'll take a long time. Yeah. But, when you said, the caller made that statement about reparations, I just thought about labor power and how cultural workers have labor. They are selling their labor power, and that is never, ever compensated in an equitable manner. So I definitely see if the investment in the arts as an investment in people's labor power, which is their cultural work. Mm-hmm. So, and that's never truly, people have never really gotten the return on the amount of cultural labor power that they put out there. So that's the first thing that popped in my mind. The second thing is this conversation about, are there big pockets of money? Are there not big pockets of money? There are teeny pockets of money everywhere. Understanding how that money comes in and how it flows and what the actual breakdown looks like in terms of how much people are actually receiving versus how much folks are just receiving to fix their buildings, that is a conversation that needs to happen. We need to understand how the money flows and where the money goes and how it's actually really, truly distributed for us to even have a conversation about big pockets of money or little pockets of money, whichever, even if imaginary or true. I don't know.
Yeah, I completely agree. See, that's the article I want to read. Well, I want the education about the flows of money, and I want the education about the flows of resources and how they can be better distributed, more so than big. I also completely agree with our last caller about, it's something we face at the museum all the time. We cannot keep operating at the way that we want to, at the whims of various funding sources that exist. Mm-hmm. And we respect and love the ones that support us, and they give us the grace to do so. But if I don't want to take a transformation grant because I don't know that my organization is actually equipped to do right by that, we have to find new funding structures, and we have to be more patron-driven. And I think there is a large race conversation happening amongst the funding world. But with that said, I also don't want to perpetuate the sentiment that white funders are only funding white projects and black funders are only funding black projects, because I don't think that's true at all. I think there's a lot of cross things that are happening. I think, again, the larger conversation is about geography and where certain things are happening in the city and where they're not.
You know, we said transportation geography, and that, you know, is very real. But I also think there are more, like grantors are, in the city are more willing to fund things that are in East Baltimore because Hopkins is there, or, you know, Mike is in the center of the city versus West Baltimore. And I saw it as a nonprofit professional. That's what I've been in my whole working life, you know. And so I've kind of, I've seen that. And the reality is, if I have a certain agenda and if the people who are giving me money want a certain thing, then they want to see something happen. And the city's agenda, they want a lot more people from elsewhere to come into the city. I asked my friend who does development in Philadelphia, and I lived there for a couple of years when I went to college, and the Philly Mural Project is something that, you know, is very popular. And I said, do they use local artists to do this? Is this something that's coming out of the community? And I remember when I lived there, like, churches and schools would call and ask and request for a mural to be put up. And she said, yeah, most are coming from here, or they're based strongly in here. That is very different from how it happens here. They're coming from Paris. They're coming from South Africa. They're these images that don't reflect the community or neighborhood, if something they even like. Some of them are cool and some of them are creepy, and it makes people feel uncomfortable. I've seen, you know, and we're talking about with the city, that's been my biggest qualm, because I can't have people apologize. I mean, okay, that's been my biggest qualm. There was a peaceful hip-hop concert here at Morgan that was shut down by the police. They had helicopters. There was no violence. There was no anything that happened at this place. It's being young and Black, and that's who I'm representing, is criminal in and of itself in this city. Mm-hmm. That means that these spaces, entertainment spaces, view us as a liability, whether or not we are violent, whether or not we are disrespectful, whether or not we can bring people or not. And there's another cultural arts center that came to Baltimore that said that the city told him he could not get an entertainment license unless he said he was not going to work with urban promoters. So he doesn't have an entertainment license. He still does things because there's ways to get around it. You know, you just can't say that you're doing this. You can't too publicly advertise. So we've been forced underground because we are working and operating in spaces where we can't say this costs $10 to get in. We have to say free will donation or pre-sale tickets or can't get a liquor license. Since all of these things, this is what's happening in the city.
Mm-hmm. Baynard?
Well, I'm really glad that we're having this conversation about all of this. And I feel like that, well, Dina said that's the article she'd like to read. So that's something that we are working on, is really digging into where arts funding actually comes from in the city. And
thank you.
Unsurprisingly, a lot of people don't, other than thanking their big grantors, don't really want to talk about where their money comes from. So it takes some investigative work. And so that is something we're really looking into, is how does the arts money flow, and what is the role of the giant institutions like MICA and Hopkins, say, as they're coming into Station North, and what effect does that have on places that have already been there? So these will be series of stories that we are trying to be working on. And, you know, because it is something important. And I also want to just apologize for goofing up on the whole My little part of the state of the arts thing. Made it look like the city's just white and Black, and we also equally leave out the Latino community and a lot of other parts of the community that also need to be getting arts funding and be part of this conversation. And so, you know, that was something I screwed up on.
Well, I mean, this is a very critical conversation. We had somebody call in. There's an article in your newspaper about the Arab artists, and which is a piece I've not seen yet that I want to go see, in this town. But you know, there's so many things to talk about here. Francine has written in about conversations earlier here that when people of color tell you that experiences artists in Baltimore believe them, it's fine to amplify what you believe, and the people who are doing the inclusive work. But to characterize honest discussion as a blame game is a derailing tactic that shuts down experience of artists of color. I think there's a lot.
Praise God.
There's a lot here. I mean, it's a very complex question.
But see, I think if we keep having, with all due respect, and I apologize because I'm the one that made the blame game comment, and I want to address that for a second. I mean, but there's still something about a miseducation of how things operate, because in MIA, with all due respect, I mean, something was just said that was really fiery about Red Emma's that was not true at all.
No, and I think I didn't. I think my words were jumbled because I said that Red Emma's didn't
had
the
police
come.
That.
I said that the police did that and blamed Red Emma's.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which that's
is
what she said.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why they called in. So that's cool. I'm going to get straight.
Yeah. I know them. They know me. I work with them for years. I love
you
y'all.
Straight out.
That's fine.
But I think that, finish what you're saying before we have to.
But I think if we keep having this conversation from this white versus black lens, as opposed to, again, talking about larger concerns for the art world and for our arts community and for whether or not the city's actually investing in it or not, because what you were saying about permits and liquor licenses and not being able to sell, I mean, that's happening all over the city for artists living in warehouses in the Copycat and for artists operating in neighborhoods that are not in an arts district, old, young, white, black. I mean, this, I mean, Baynard, can you...
But they, for years, were able to do that before police. It was only been for the past year or so. And honestly, and I don't want to say it, but, you know, when they started being a little bit more inclusive is when the city started saying, the reality is with gentrification and even at this thing, they called it creative placemaking, using art to create a new space. They use artists to try to fix up these spaces, and then the city comes back and takes them and sell them to bigger developers and bigger art things. So everybody's being used, and
so
I understand that.
I wish we had another hour here, but we're off the air here in just a few minutes. This has really been an important conversation. I really appreciate the absolute honesty and openness of this conversation today. It's really important to have. Mia Loving, good to have you back in the studio. Gina Gaga, great to have you back in the studio
as well.
Thank you for being part of this. Kalima Young, thank you for instigating this discussion in the City Paper, the article. And
let's keep having it.
Thank you for allowing the City Paper to open these discussions for our whole community to wrestle with. And we're going to come back to this often, because I think it's one we have to have, and I do want to see where Station North is going. I think that's going to be kind of an epicenter of pushing where what it could look like, not allowing it to happen without it being the place that it can be, that it needs to be.
But we do have to talk about race, and we have to keep it on the table.
We do. So Kalima Young, Dina Hagag, Mia Loving, Baynard Woods, thank four of you
thank
so
you.
Much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. We're going to go out. You'll hear Under Me, Apartheid by Peter Tosh, born on this day yesterday, and born on this day in 1944. Reminding you that this weekend at Everyman Theater, I'm hosting The World of the Play, A New Top Gun, A New War, on Saturday, October 25th at 5 p.m. Conversation grows out of Everyman's current performance of Grounded. Join our World of the Play panel discussion as we interrogate the topical themes surrounding women in the military, motherhood, and the ethics of drone warfare. Just go to everymantheater.org and join the conversation. And also reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Sienna Greaves. Go to steinershow.org to podcast this and find that information about our guests. You can also download on iTunes now, The Mark Steiner Show. And for public radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. We gonna fight.